Welcome, everyone, to the first John Cain Luncheon for 2024, hosted by Per Capita and our friends that we merged with at the John Cain Foundation. For those of you who may not know me, we've got some new faces here today. My name is Emma Dawson and I'm Executive Director at Per Capita. I would like to start by acknowledging that we meet today on the lands of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation and pay my respects to their elders past and present. Thank them for their custodianship over many generations of the land on which we meet, which was never ceded. Before I start today, I do want to point out to you, it's our first meeting of 2024. If you haven't already, you can pick up our impact summary, which shows you the achievements we made in 2023. But I just want to add one verbally, which is, since we last met, the Stage 3 tax cuts have been fixed. And aren't we delighted about that? I think it's 6 years that I've been banging on about that. And what the Parliament, what the Treasurer and the Cabinet have come up with is a much, much better use of that money to support people who genuinely need it in lower and middle income brackets. Those at the top still get about $4,500 a year, so I'm not sure why they're whinging. But it's also a non-inflationary package and I think really an excellent outcome for all of us who have been lobbying for that for some time. So well done, us. our guest today is the inimitable Julian Hill MP for Bruce, a Victorian MP, friend of Per Capita's, friend of mine, and many of yours as well. And Julian's here to talk to us about his recent work. Don't know what he did to deserve this, but was asked to head up the Parliamentary Inquiry into Workforce Australia. It was a mammoth task, as you will be able to see from the size of the report that his committee has produced, and which I have read cover to cover, as has May Lamb on my team, who unfortunately can't be with us today. It's an important inquiry into a really critical issue if we are going to build an economy that promotes opportunity, that ensures that all Australians have the chance to fulfil their talents, to live a good life and to obtain a good, secure job. It's core Labor business and Julian has taken it very seriously, so please welcome him to talk to you about it today.
Hello, everyone at home. Can I thank you for the invitation, Emma, to be here. I'll echo your acknowledgement of the traditional owners, the Wurundjeri and the Woiwurrung people, but really only just two acknowledgements. I look around the room and I've been moving around. There's a whole lot of my former lives colliding from time in local government, from my time in the Victorian Public Service and around the Labor movement. So g'day to everyone who I haven't got around to yet, but really to acknowledge you, Emma, and your leadership and work, but particularly also you and May in terms of the input you had publicly and also as a confidant and sounding board throughout the what seems like 50-year-long journey to produce the report. Don't be scared. There's only two or three paragraphs I'm going to read at various points in my very, very detailed, overburdened preparation here. But it is a really weighty and serious bit of work on a serious topic. Can I also acknowledge the Honourable Brian Howe, AO, Australia's 8th Deputy Prime Minister. Of course, you're not as old as that may make you sound, because we didn't invent the office of Deputy Prime Minister until a long time after Federation, but one of the very few people in the Parliament who was a minister the entire time in the Hawke Keating Labor governments, right from 1983 to 1996, a giant reformer, a social policy reformer, despite the trolling of your first ministerial appointment being Minister for Defence Personnel, which you made a good fist of, but every time I see you, I am both pleased, warm, and also feel slightly guilty for what I did to your photocopier as a young Labor activist. So thank you. Look, what I want to do is frame a discussion and leave, you know, a fair good amount of time for some question and answer and feedback. The disclaimer I'll put up front is this is not government policy. This is a parliamentary committee input, broadly cross-partisan with a couple of wrinkles there, and there's no key messages except to acknowledge that everyone gets a tax cut, not just the select few. So thanks for that, Emma. The report itself now, as in the way as parliamentary reports, is with executive government and the public service to chew on, which they're doing currently. So no hints. Sorry for anyone who turned up expecting hints about where we may land, but it is being taken seriously. Look, to set the scene, this was a very peculiar inquiry. The Minister, Tony Burke, approached me and asked me to chair it and said he wanted to set up a House Select Committee soon after the election. I say peculiar for a couple of reasons. It was a wicked problem, but we had no sense of where we wanted to land, quite genuinely. We did not embark on the inquiry with a set of answers or preconceived landing points. Very old-fashioned to follow the evidence and see where you go. Australia, though, for 25 years, best part of three decades, has been an outlier, if you look globally, in terms of having fully marketised employment services. We're a poster child, almost a kind of a curious circus animal for the OECD and other nations that come and look and go, well, of course, at one extreme is the Australian system. That's not to say that everything about it was bad. If you look, it was actually pretty cheap and efficient at helping or pushing people close to the labour market back into work so they didn't get stuck or scarred too long. Beyond that, it's a pretty short list of things that you'd say it did really well. When we came to government, we had a natural question mark over close to $7 billion of contracts that had been signed just before caretaker period on the eve of an election. And I think an accumulated set of frustrations for members of the caucus over many terms and years, however long people had been there, about what we see in our electorate offices day to day from people who are just not supported by the system. The disclaimer, again, I'll put at the front, is there are so many truly wonderful people who work in this system and achieve small miracles, often against the odds. So none of this is a criticism of the workforce. And I'll touch on the workforce in a moment. It's an examination of the system. The other thing I'll just note is there was a very conscious choice, and I think what proved to be a wise choice by the minister, to get a bunch of politicians to do this, as opposed to people much cleverer and much more expert than us. We could have got, you know, professors, we could have got consultants, we could have got labour market experts. You know, the previous reviews were well-intentioned, guided by the people who really know the system in and out. But I think, for two reasons, and I think we've done justice to these aspects. One, there's an inherent set of questions that only politicians can answer in this. At the core of it, what is it reasonable for a society to expect people who are unemployed to do and require them to do, and what kind of help can be provided or should be provided? And second, to challenge existing orthodoxy, because much of the public service and indeed our great and the good in this sector, it's almost become like the boiled frog. We only know what we know because that's what we know. And why do we do it? Well, that's how we did it last year. So I think for those two reasons, they wanted a bunch of politicians to look at it. It was a genuine first principles inquiry, the first in three decades. We decided to read. We spent a few months reading and doing private hearings, finding the cleverest people we could. I did a coming out speech, as I call it, to the CEOs of NESA, where we threw a few rocks in the pond, provided a critique and analysis, and I think got people to realise we were deadly serious about having a fresh look at things. We did a submission guide, and then there was 12 months of sleeves rolled up work with hearings, submissions, visits, including engagement with at least 12 other nations directly through the OECD in Paris, and then some European comparators who had different systems to ours. So we took it seriously. I can say on a personal level, it was, and I see Alison and people I worked with, Julian, in the department in previous lives, it was probably the most complex piece of public policy review that I've done. And I've looked after metropolitan planning strategy, business engagement, all sorts of different things. And probably for 9 months, I had a sense of personal panic and confusion because I genuinely had no idea. The more you learnt, the more confused you got about what on earth you would do. And you've always got to have a view about where you might land. It was like the elephant in the sort of wardrobe or the monster in the wardrobe. At some point, we're going to have to write a report. But I crossed the Rubicon mid last year when I concluded very clearly that not just does the system not work effectively, it actually can't work effectively in the way it's been designed because of some fundamental flaws. And I'll just highlight two up front. One is what I'd argue, and we argued in the report, is a flawed theory of unemployment that we've been guided by since the Howard years, which suggests that unemployment is always an individual personal failing. And that's the whole ideology that has sat around and driven, the myth of the dole bludger, that anyone who is out of paid employment, there's something wrong with them and it's their fault. Completely ignores the realities of friction through the labour market in a market economy, but more fundamentally, it ignores the myriad of structural barriers which confront a lot of our citizens, be that limited capacity, a lack of skills because of early life issues, you know, fetal alcohol syndrome, all sorts of things that the individual is just not going to succeed. The most pernicious we found around the country is age discrimination, some of the most impactful conversations with people who've worked all their lives and through all of the vagaries of life are not in work now, and they can't get back into work because of structural discrimination, whether it's disability, health, and so on, or episodic mental illness, episodic health conditions. So all of these things which are part of the human condition are just not taken into account in this theory of unemployment that it's always your fault. The second flawed belief that you've got to understand right up front to make sense of where we've landed is this flawed belief that more competition will always somehow magically deliver better outcomes for vulnerable people or vulnerable consumers, if you want to use that language. That's not to say there's not a role for contestability and choice. There is. We're not recommending recreating a giant monolithic bureaucracy that does everything. You know, disappointing some, we got those submissions, but you know, it's a flawed belief that the way that theories of competition and marketisation have been applied, we argue. So where we landed was that it's more than just tinkering. And there, when I said I was confused and panicked for about 6 or 9 months, you sort of spent some days thinking, oh, yeah, OK, maybe they've got a point. Maybe if we just tinker with the incentives and change the commissioning models and redraw the regions, then it'll all be OK. And then you spend other moments going, this is just crazy where we've ended up, where everyone's running around competing for outcome payments, shoving people into any job, whether it's suitable, because you can't pay your staff and run your service. And we got, you know, 5 or 10 people all doing the same thing in a region in a Hunger Games-style consulting model. So you kind of live between these two realities. But we concluded we need a fundamental rebuild. It shouldn't be controversial to say that full privatisation has failed, which is something we said, because even the Liberals, you know, who love to outsource anything they can get their hands on, even they concluded in their previous term of government in the establishment of Workforce Australia that the largest share of the caseload would be bought back in-house to be overseen by the public sector through the digital online services. And that's indeed a reform direction which every country's going in, whatever the degree of marketisation and contestability and service partners, that it's cheaper and more efficient and more sensible to help those people closest to the labour market and activate them, whatever language you want to use, run by the public sector. So it shouldn't be controversial. Some days it is. We concluded that we no longer have a functioning national coherent employment service system. We've got an inefficient outsourced Centrelink compliance management system with some terrific people working throughout it that sometimes get people a job despite all of the barriers in their way. So it is a 648-page report. Don't be scared. I'm just going to give you a quick headline summary of the case for the prosecution, if you like, the sort of flaws that we found, the key recommendations, and then seed the discussion around future of public services. So some of the summary of flaws and issues. It doesn't work for long-term unemployed people. The data's clear. We've got a red-hot labour market, yet the system has not prepared too many people on the long-term unemployment caseload for the jobs that are around now. Yes, human capital, yes, training, but so much of it's been driven by trying to meet points targets and mutual obligation requirements, because otherwise you get your payment cut off, rather than actually rationally investing in something that may benefit the person in front of you to get a job that's realistic in the labour market. Look, I think the figures probably understates it, but the previous review found that only 4% of employers anymore use the system. 4% use the public employment service system. Now, it's probably a bit more than that. I actually think that's probably an underestimate for a range of reasons. But even, you know, double it, triple it. You're talking, you know, you're lucky to get to sort of fingers and toes, if we're counting percentages, of people who use the public employment service system. Like I said, it's reasonably efficient for those closest to the labour market, but structurally, long-term unemployment just slowly kept growing, and the labour market economists said it's structurally higher than you would have predicted under the previous kind of public models. Second point I'd make is around mutual obligations. The Robodebt Royal Commission found that fraud in the welfare system is, to quote the Royal Commissioner Catherine Holmes, minuscule. The way we've applied mutual obligations, I'm not saying the existence of participation requirements, whatever you want to call them, every system in the developed world has some kind of participation requirements, and it's an inherently political question, stemmed from the 1700s and 1800s with Victorian laws and, you know, the problem of the unemployed, as the language used to be. But the way they've been applied is like using a nuclear bomb to kill a mosquito. If you actually look at what we've done to the system, it is tied up in red tape. Verging on 50% of a provider's time now is spent on policing mutual obligations, typing crap into the computer for Centrelink, and dealing with the inefficient IT and administration. I mean, that's just mad. The frontline services are burdened and being drowned in red tape, and we had metrics around that. That's driving employers away, but it's also making many people less employable by requiring them to do things which either actively harm them, the constant mental health impacts of being rejected, being forced to apply for jobs that you know you're not going to get, forced to do training courses that tell 50-year-olds with a work history to get out of bed on time. I mean, all of those things can have a place and can have benefit, but the way they've been applied and the universality and the one-size-fits-all approach has actually not helped. We've designed the system, if you like, around the worst people in society and the worst providers, and everyone else gets lumped into that paradigm. Supply and demand, as I said, this flawed theory that if we only focus on supply ever more and somehow beat unemployed people ever harder, they'll magically get a job. The system should be about better connecting supply with demand, about both creating jobs, whether that's entry-level jobs through, you know, public contracts, social procurement obligations and so on, or actually working with employers. Fourth issue I'd just note, the destruction of that sense of localism. Social capital's actually a thing. Alison, Julian and I used to write about this. Social capital's a real thing. It's relationships in communities, and it's at the local level that, you know, skilled caseworkers, good services actually have relationships with local businesses. I'll come to the market design flaws in a moment that mitigate against that. As well, the Commonwealth has no view on quality or a service model. One of the most impactful moments with the excellent bureaucrats, they're very skilled at what they do and what they've been asked to do, was we had all of them lined up. We had deputy secretaries and the secretary and first assistant secretaries and some assistant secretaries and this kind of whole phalanx in that giant room, the big committee room. It's all very serious. And I said, oh, could someone explain to me what's a good service model? Could you just step me through? And we had the gaping fish. And you know, the long, awkward silence where everyone kind of goes, oh God, who's going to take that one? And someone made a valiant effort and said, well, we don't really have a view at the service model. We manage by KPIs and outcomes and stuff. That, as we concluded, is a genuine problem. That the Commonwealth has no view on what a quality service is or how you run an employment service anymore. Competition. Look, the way that competition has been applied, we concluded, is a problem. And if you go to any town centre, I represent, you know, Dandenong, the most multicultural place in Australia, one of the most socioeconomically disadvantaged municipalities. Go to any regional centre, you know, Shepparton, Wodonga, we went to regional Australia. Pretty much every street corner, you'll find an employment service provider because we've got this theory of competition that's no one's questioned, that you need four or five providers doing largely the same thing, plus a bunch of DES providers, disability employment service, plus a transition to work youth provider. From employers' perspective, this is just crazy. Like, who are all these people? It's fragmented, there's no coherence to the service system, they're all knocking on their door desperate to try and chase an outcome payment. No wonder they disconnect. And so the fragmentation there is an inherent part of the design based on a flawed theory of competition. In 22% of the regions, we went to Cairns, for example, but 22% of the regions, last tendering round, lost 100% of their providers. So all of the relationships with employers, all of the relationships with clients, bang, gone in a tendering round. You've got a whole new crop of people coming in. So it's an inherent problem in the market design. My two favourite paragraphs in the report are paragraph 2.94 and paragraph 2.49, strangely. Paragraph 2.94 makes the point that there's kind of four things that you really need to be confident on if you want to keep operating this massive quasi-market system with no direct government involvement. You've got to understand that fair chunk of your money will go on profit and surplus. Fair enough. You know, it's nothing that you're not for profit, you're not for loss. So a bit of what you spend will go on that. The tendering costs run to hundreds of millions every round. So you've got to be confident you're going to get better value for money and better quality and so on out of the other end, because you're literally standing on the oval throwing away hundreds of millions of dollars of cash on tendering costs and lawyers and probity consultants and bids and, you know, the taxpayer ultimately pays for every lease that closes and every new computer system that gets bought and all the new signs and logos. So it's hundreds of millions of dollars every round, as the OECD says. But then you've got an army managing the interface. Most of the public servants manage contracts and KPIs, and you've got significant proportion, about 20, 30%, I think, don't hold me to the figure, of staff in the entities that do administration and contract management and quality management and reporting. So you've got to be confident with those four cost items that you're going to get better value for money from running this quasi-market than you would by changing the level of competition or bringing some stuff back in-house. I just also make the point with that kind of competition point that the theory of lots of competition and marketisation will get great innovation and great quality, and it'll all be cool because everyone will compete and they'll specialise. The reality is, as every country that's operated a quasi-market like this, and I'm labouring this point because it's got a broader point for human services at the other end, every country that's run a quasi-market like this quickly or slowly figures out that government has to heavily regulate and prescribe the quasi-market because otherwise people profiteer grossly. So in the first round, even Howard figured this out pretty quickly. You had people getting a contract going, oh, this is pretty good. I just kind of won't employ many staff and I don't really care if I don't meet any KPIs because look, I made $17 million. I won't get another contract, but I made $17 million. So you actually have to heavily regulate. The point we've got to now is the department issues, you know, a 600-page manual that largely codifies and standardises and prescribes what people do. It limits innovation. And then the Hunger Games contracting model means everyone lives in fear of losing their contract, so they all largely do the same thing. They'll put different face on it, they'll get a bit of different service model, but they converge at the same point. There's very little overperformance and excellence. There's relatively little awful performance. Most of them cluster within a median band. So you kind of scratch your head and go, well, where are the benefits of all this competition and choice from the Hunger Games model? Final couple of things I just noticed problems. The workforce, it's a deprofessionalised, de-unionised, female-dominated, low-paid workforce. Oh, another one of those. With a 40% annual churn, we've seen. 40%. If as you and I were talking, you did a PhD in this. Yep, 40% annual churn. The most important factor, if you had to pick one, to get a vulnerable or long-term unemployed person back connected with the labour market is a trusted relationship with a skilled case manager. Like, if you had to pick one. How on earth can you do that when you're de-unionised, de-professionalised, and you've got five case managers in a year? You can't be vulnerable. You can't build trust. And it just doesn't work. The final thing I'd just note, for people furthest from the labour market, I won't labour the point, we could talk about it if you like, every human society has a cohort of people who are not meeting the threshold for a disability pension, whatever the society calls it, but everyone knows they're not going to compete in the private labour market, at least permanently. They might have episodic mental illness, they might have caring responsibilities, they might have some of the other structural barriers that we've talked about. In old-fashioned terms, they may be just not quite right. They're the people who, you know, most days they're good and then they come into our electorate office and randomly scream at people. They're not bad people. We just need to think about how we care for and include people like that rather than expecting them to somehow do things which they're not going to be able to do. So the summary of the recommendations are we need a stronger public sector core to the system. We've suggested calling that Employment Services Australia. It'd provide the stewardship and the enabling functions for the system to work in regions and also for that online case management. Heresy, I know, in the sort of neoliberal market orthodoxy, we've also said that there should be some modest elements of direct service delivery by the Commonwealth Public Service, not for reasons of cost or efficiency, but so we get some skin in the game again and rediscover what delivering employment services is like and recreate that loop between service delivery and policy development that, you know, good theory, any public policy school will say you need. Second area for reform would be mutual obligations and compliance. Compliance and mutual obligations will be part of the system, but they should operate in the background, not be the first thought that everyone goes to. There's a whole bunch of stuff, and that's paragraph 2.49, which I might touch on in a sec, about intrinsic versus extrinsic motivations. But we've said we need to broaden and tailor the mutual obligations rather than one size fits all, and not ask people to do things which will harm them or reduce their chances of getting a job, but ask them to do things which are in line with their goals, aspirations, capabilities, and their individual plan. We've also said quite clearly that the ability to impact a person's social security payment should only be made by a public servant. It shouldn't be automated, and it shouldn't be outsourced, just as a matter of kind of ethics and base public administration. We said that we need to better connect the supply and demand, which means focusing on employers as well. We need a sort of a single front door, hide the wiring, if you like, for employers to overcome this fragmentation problem that's driving them away, and things like entry-level jobs, social procurement. We said clearly we need to dial back the level of competition and blow up, change the sort of regional structure and the market structure. What we've suggested is a larger number of smaller regions. The current regions are giant. They're drawn not to reflect regional labour markets, they're drawn to reflect this theory of Commonwealth procurement and ease of Commonwealth procurement, that you need a certain number of providers of a certain scale to be efficient, and therefore we draw the region that large. They're disconnected from employers, from councils, from chambers of commerce, from industry groups, people who actually have social capital to get people into work. So we've said redraw the boundaries based on actual regional labour markets. Look at one mainstream provider per place with a very different commissioning model and market culture. If you take the OH&S example, I think Mark Considine gave me this in one of our discussions. If you take the OH&S regulatory culture, the inspector comes in and looks at the building, and there's a few things. If they see, you shut down. You know, if there's water dripping into the light, you shut down till it's fixed. Someone might die. But most things in an OH&S inspection become areas that you work on for quality improvement between the regulator and the service partner. They're not reasons to say, ha, we've scored you, you're going to lose your contract, you die now, we'll get someone else. Like, you actually have a partnership model to improving in place. So if you've got a stronger public sector core that helps people steward in a region, that does better assessment, that streams people, and I think the analogy I used was, you use a GP to navigate the health system. You don't try and figure out which specialist and which diagnostic test you need. You go to your navigator, your GP dating agent. I think the minister was talking about if you go to an emergency department in a hospital, you don't give everyone the same operation and the same prescription, which too often is what we do now. So the public sector can do that stewarding and actually stream people, do proper, deeper assessment. And then you've got a richer ecosystem of providers and options for people in place. You might have a mainstream provider. The obvious specialist providers are called. This is what the evidence says. You probably need a culturally and linguistically diverse provider. You definitely need a standalone youth service, different pedagogy, different way of engaging in services, different issues with aspiration and so on. You need disability services, which are there, whatever model you put them in. Definitely Indigenous services. We've quoted the Productivity Commission's work that Aboriginal community-controlled organisations are going to get better results overall. So we've given a strong rec there. But also ex-offender services, which are just dreadful. So that's a state and territory Commonwealth issue that we said needs a standalone service. We've also given a really big push towards social enterprise, because for some people, social enterprise, for those furthest from the labour market, maybe their journey back to the labour market. For others, it's their destination, and that's okay. So there's a range of recommendations we've given there. We can talk about it. If I'd wrap that up by saying, our argument is we need to rebuild a public sector capability at the core. That doesn't mean doing most of the case management, but it does mean knowing about case management and doing a bit of it. And it means the stewardship enabling functions in each region. It's a shift in philosophy from contracting everything out to contracting service partners in, which frankly is how most other human service areas actually work. This has become a weird outlier. If you think about health, education, vocational training, even parts of aged care, we didn't fully marketise everything. You've got a rich ecosystem of private, not-for-profit specialist services sitting around a public core to the system. And that's our argument, that we need to move back to that kind of model. Workforce, as I said, the single most important factor. We said unashamedly we need to reprofessionalise, so I can touch on that if people are interested. The last couple of sort of headline recs, if you look at our spend as compared to the OECD, Australia in aggregate spends about half the OECD average on employment services writ large. If you disaggregate that, we spend more than the OECD average on the operating core of the system, but we spend a fraction of the OECD average on active labour market programs, paid internships, workplace-based training. Now, I know this is controversial with some of our ACTU friends at times, but our argument is that we've got to, yes, human capital is important, yeah, TAFE courses have a role, but the evidence internationally is clear that for people furthest from the labour market, training based in workplaces, training by employers, is more effective to reintegrate someone and give them a go. That raises a whole lot of issues. Yes, some people won't work out. I get that. And yes, you've got to deal with integrity and cheating the system, but it is a significant shift in how we should be thinking about investing through active labour market programs. So our argument very, very clearly is it's much better to pay an employer, provided the integrity things are managed, to give someone a go and put wraparound support and training in, whatever the wraparound support needed. Ultimately, that's a better investment for society than what we're currently doing, or just leaving people on unemployment benefits. So we shouldn't be scared to invest more money in well-designed programs there, which, frankly, I think is what your government did with Working Nation. And there's a lot to commend with some of those program designs. Not a lot new in this space. It's a bit back to the future. The very final thing is an independent regulator. And pretty much everyone agreed with that for all sorts of different reasons. Our proposal, but government will work it through, is that we need an independent regulator to set workforce standards, to set a view about quality frameworks and what a quality service should be, to take on that continuous learning function. I've got no time for this view of, you know, that some providers have put, well, that's my IP, I'm not sharing my secret sauce. Basically, if you want to take taxpayer money to deliver these kind of services, you should be required to share your learnings, whether it's community of practice, through the regulator, across the system, otherwise, don't play. We have to find a way to share learnings across the system and what good practice is. Advising on pricing and funding, and also a complaints management function, independent of providers in the department. So they could sit, we think, in a regulator. You can design it in different ways. Final couple of things in terms of next steps. Some people within government have said, look, this is an excellent report, we're looking at it, but why is it so bloody long? I said, well, two things. One, if you want to get your head around it, read the chair's summary, the chair's forward, it's an excellent forward, I might say, and read the one or two page chapter summaries at the start of each chapter. That's all you need to read to get the gist of the report. But the primary audience for this, multiple audiences, the primary audience is actually the Commonwealth Public Service. I just want to read you two paragraphs to emphasise that point. Most people would be familiar with Terry Moran, who's been banging on about the need for reform in this area for years and years. You know, I caught up with him a few times. I won't verbal him further, but let me read this paragraph. Numerous experts, academics, former senior public servants and practitioners have cautioned the committee that the biggest obstacle to system reform is likely to be entrenched resistance, even hostility, in parts of the Australian public service, given a decades-long belief in full marketisation, a lack of experience in service delivery, and the sheer convenience of being able to blame contractors for systemic failures. As outlined in the report, successive governments and senior bureaucrats have remained detached from the messy reality of communities, regional labour markets and service delivery. As with other privatisations, bureaucrats and politicians avoided direct responsibility for systemic failures and public discontent by blaming contracted providers. The shift proposed in this report is significant, and challenging orthodoxy brings risk, but change is essential as the current system simply does not and cannot work. And I hope that they're chewing on it well, but a big part of the reason we wrote such a comprehensive report is to take every possible argument, every piece of evidence we got, dissect it and put a view. There's very few loose ends or loose threads that were left from the evidence. They're in there. We'll see what they make of it. The final point I'd make, and this is for all of us in terms of sort of going forward with this topic, paragraph 16.6, central to any serious effort to reform the system and improve outcomes for long-term unemployed and disadvantaged Australians will be a fundamental change in both political and community attitudes to unemployed people and recipients of income support. Most Australians want to work. Most Australians do not cheat the system. Those who do cheat the system or are otherwise persistently or deliberately non-compliant should be dealt with via social security compliance mechanisms. But it's absolutely critical that everyone's not lumped into that paradigm. And I go on to quote the Royal Commissioners from Robodebt, that very evocative paragraph there, where she makes that point in relation to Robodebt. So, look, the final thing to set the discussion, that's employment services as best I could sort of do a 648-page report in about 25 minutes. Some of the interesting things that come out of that for those public sector policy nerds like me and others in the room I know, What are the implications more broadly for public sector, public service reform? Chapter 2, if you're a public sector nerd, read Chapter 2. It's the case for the prosecution or the critique and analysis. It's a direct challenge or punch in the head to some of the neoliberal orthodoxy that we've now had for 20 to 30 years and new public management theories and quasi-market models. New public management levers absolutely have a place, but we've overused them. That's effectively where we landed, and they've gone well beyond their limits. Targets, choice and competition, you know, quasi-market regulation, they've got a place. But we've really challenged the orthodoxy on outsourcing and said government has to be smarter about how and when the private sector or the not-for-profit are engaged or contracted in, not contracted out, and challenge this view that's built up. It's an ideology the Libs preach, that the private sector is always somehow magically cheaper or more efficient or more effective. The evidence is really clear. That's simply not always true. There are things. Absolutely, you can contract out. You can buy in expertise. There's commercial expertise and other sorts of things you don't have or will go stale in the public sector. But it's, we really need to have skin in the game as one of our conclusions, and that's a lesson across a whole range of other areas. Core public sector service capability and having a view on service models and what you're commissioning. To put it in plain terms, if you think about in state governments got themselves for a while without any in-house rail engineering expertise or too little, how do you know if you're buying $100 million of crap or not if you're not an informed, smart customer? And how do you remain an informed, smart customer if you don't have some in-house capability? So it's an issue and a question right across government. If you had to pick one, I'd probably say ICT is still the biggest issue with that at the moment. Cheap and efficient, and I'll end here, cheap and efficient, though, are not the only measures that we should be thinking about in this discussion more broadly. Quality public services are a sign of a civilised society and they need great skilled public servants to deliver them. Doesn't mean doing every activity, but that shouldn't be a controversial statement. And the language of cheap and efficient seems to have become for too long the dominant thing. It's the only thing which we value or talk about. And the finance department absolutely has a role to play in maintaining discipline, but they shouldn't be specifying what we're trying to buy. You know, society should also be asking what is good, what is right, what is fair, what is needed for business and people. And they're values-based questions which are in the realm of the political. So circle back to where I started. It's a serious bit of work. Yes, it has a narrow application in relation to employment services, but I think there's some broader conversations and things for the labour movement as a whole about our view about public sector capability and public sector service delivery and how we kind of get that balance right. So I'll end there and happy to sort of have a chat or take some questions. Thanks, Emma.